So I just want to talk briefly about the other MGWA white papers and what they have been used for. I'm currently one of the committee members for the white paper. The manganese paper, manganese and Minnesota groundwater, you can see the team that worked on this paper on the right here. Anybody in the room want to raise their hand that was on that team? Okay, so over here, oh, back in the corner too, Rich Sewell and Vanessa, and I saw one other hand. This white paper has also had some legs. It kind of changed our understanding of manganese in groundwater from just a nuisance that's widespread across the state to one that is a health risk. So we currently have some standards for manganese in drinking water at which it becomes a problem, and usually it's a problem with neurological issues, mostly in infants. So the standard is now 300 micrograms a liter per liter for adults, but if it's an infant on formula, it's much less because that's just when the neurological damage occurs. The EPA has a different standard, even lower. Unfortunately, these are not enforceable standards. They're not regulated. It's not required to be monitored. Usually you see manganese in drinking water in Minnesota associated with certain glacial till layers and associated with iron as well. The standards are unlikely to come anytime soon. So this would be something that is now in the realm of education for the public and communication about what the health risks are. So that was the purpose of this white paper, is to kind of get our understanding of it out there into the world and our recommendations as well. Hold on, I did something here. There we go. So the recommendations coming from the white paper were to study the neurological effects more closely, correlate groundwater manganese concentrations to tap water concentrations, understand more about the spatial distribution of manganese in Minnesota's groundwater, and coordinate the monitoring efforts. We currently have many different state agencies looking at different aspects of groundwater, and if we could coordinate our understanding of manganese, we could also better predict where it's going to occur, and then evaluate manganese removal from water. There have been some requests for information based on this white paper. I know that Mindy Erickson has given a talk to a group that was working on the potential for redox conditions associated with landfills to change manganese mobilization down gradient from the landfill. This is a group that was active in Washington County that was trying to get some legislation around this. So they asked her to come and present. And there have been some other requests about these negative health impacts. Obviously, that's not something that we as groundwater people do, but there is a request out there to understand how this affects the developing brain of children. And now recently, Kara Santelli, who's at the University of Minnesota in Earth Sciences, her geomicrobiology lab is working on potential remediation processes associated with microbial species that might help change the reduction and oxidation of the water associated with manganese. And I know that Peter Kang, who's a new hydrogeologist at the University of Minnesota, is also interested in this. So this white paper is in their hands. I sent it to them, and I would encourage all of you who have interest in this topic or know of people that might, this is the white paper from your organization. It's kind of our job to see that it has legs. It sits on our website, but it's our job to take it out there into the world, testify where we need to. The Minnesota Groundwater Education Gap white paper, again, here's the committee. Anybody from that committee in the room want to raise their hands? So we have one, two, Jeff Stoner back here. This one also has had a lot of legs. This was used, well, let me just go back and say the conclusions were that the public lacks knowledge about the quality and local resources. They're uncertain about the roles of local government, state government, federal agencies, and the different agencies in the state and how they affect groundwater. And that there is limited coordination to promote a statewide groundwater education program. So the improvements were needed in all three areas, K through 12, and that can happen through academic standards. Is anybody in the room currently involved in the academic standard effort, which is kind of being finalized now? One right here. We might want to talk to you later. And that the post-secondary education requirements for entry-level groundwater-related jobs were kind of a little bit of a mess. Our state agencies require a certain number of groundwater courses for a hydro position. The universities didn't necessarily understand that, so there was this disconnect between job requirements and what was being offered at the schools. And that we needed better groundwater education for those people out there on the land managing water resources. So people working in city water plants or regional DNR offices everywhere. Whoops, I don't know what that black thing is. The schools that were surveyed, many of them only have three of the 12 schools surveyed offered coursework beyond the introductory level in hydrogeology. And yet, if you look at the bar graph on the right, basic hydrology was deemed one of the most important school classes for students to have coming out of their undergraduate education. So the blue bars indicate the essential courses that the professionals in the region surveyed said the students needed to have, and hydrology, groundwater theory, are right up there at the very top. Statewide groundwater education is currently mainly being conducted by the group I work for right now, Freshwater Society, as well as some efforts right now through DNR and Health, and you'll hear about one at the very end of the day today from the DNR. And I know that Tanny Eschenauer is making an effort to get groundwater education out there into the public sphere, as has Sharon Pfeiffer been trying to do this for years through the DNR. The solutions really are in the academic standards, improving the academic standards beyond just an understanding of the water cycle for K through 12. Have teachers have better access to information, and filling these education gaps, and improve communication with post-secondary schools. And activities that have aligned with these recommendations, I'm not saying that they were emerged from this report, but they're kind of happening at the same time. The University of Minnesota did form an Earth Sciences Advisory Board, external advisory board, to help them with their curriculum and their degree work so that the students coming out of the university would better serve the regional geologists. They used the Minnesota Groundwater Education Report in this effort. There has been some groundwater conservation training coming out of the Met Council, and there's some online curriculum that we're offering at Freshwater. And these groundwater education efforts, spearheaded by Sharon Pfeiffer and Tanny Eschenauer and others at the state, are getting courses out there on the ground for local government and water resource managers. I would offer up also the Carlton Geothermal Project as groundwater education. They drilled like 500 wells to get the campus carbon neutral by some date soon, and Kelton and Bob Tipping have been working with the faculty down there to make this a groundwater lab for the students on campus. And also the Legislative Water Commission just 2 days ago met and asked questions about Chuck Wieger, the senator from the White Bear Lake area, and Representative Peter Fisher, also from that region, talked about the need for groundwater education in K through 12 especially, and Jim Stark offered up the Minnesota Groundwater Association report and offered someone to come, so be prepared. Finally, the current white paper is on chloride and stormwater infiltration, and you can't see that at all. I think the color's changed on me. We have three chapters. We have a good group of people involved. Would those people in the room raise their hand? Involved in the chloride work group. They're kind of in the thick of it right now, writing their chapters. We have three chapters, chloride in the environment and stormwater infiltration practices. And we have selected a lead writer recently. Sharon Koenig is going to be the lead writer. Mike Trojan is leading this work group. And they're well on the way to having something to present in time, hopefully, for the Road Salt Conference that's going to be in February. So save the date for that. At least there will be a fact sheet that will be distributed to the people that are attending that Road Salt Conference. And now I'm going to turn it over to David Christman for the next topic.
So we hope that by telling you the stories of the first four white papers that you understand that the purpose of the program is being met, and that we have some fairly well-defined processes that are functioning good, and that the work group results are valuable. And so it's that time where we need to ask you to start sending in ideas, or at least thinking of those ideas for the next white paper. So the white paper begins with you talking to colleagues, or maybe taking something from today's meeting, and kind of letting that idea work out. What we need to get from you is a fairly well-defined scope so that the work group can take it to the next level of being very tightly scoped and something that can be produced. So begin those conversations and talk to colleagues. The steering committee members are available if you have something that you want to discuss or an idea that is worth exploring. And in the winter newsletter and by a separate email, we will be providing you the process of how to put that idea together for the steering committee and submit that to us. Use the form. It gives us some structure. It also gives you some structure to develop your idea as well. And that allows us to make a better judgment on a particular topic for a white paper. Your ideas and topics, along with maybe a nucleus of a work group, is always scored very highly. It really helps when we already have a group that's in flight and or a group that's looking at it. So as you talk to colleagues, also start soliciting if people would be interested in being part of the work group. Finally, we ask you to consider being part of a work group. You don't need to be a topic expert in that particular topic or idea. What we really need is people that do basic science, which is gather information, interpret it, and communicate it. And that's the most valuable skill that any work group has. So I'm going to touch on the current ideas that we have for the work group. We have a couple that are around groundwater resource protection and mining. We like this one, but we don't like it when it is really pointing to one industry. Maybe dairy intensification could be mixed with groundwater mining, and you could develop a topic idea, and there's other facilities to consider as well. Okay, I like that term, dairy intensification, but a very neutral term. So this idea could be worked on, and if we take a look at what facilities might have impact to groundwater. The other one is the other end of the spectrum, big data, and this is such a big topic. We would have to invite everyone in the room as part of the work group, and that just becomes completely unmanageable. So think, if you're thinking a big topic, get it narrow, okay? So now's a good time to start thinking of those ideas. We have a couple of months before we'll be asking you for that, and time will always help a topic and an idea. And I can say on behalf of my other steering group committee members, we look forward to the challenge of struggling to find one idea amongst many brilliant ideas. So we look forward to your submissions. So.